The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article, by Stephanie Castillo, is titled The True Story of Selena Quintanilla's Death. It was supposed to be the start of a bright new chapter. Tejano star Selena Quintanilla Perez was working on her English crossover album, Dreaming of You, following the success of her four Spanish language albums throughout Mexico and Latin America. But before she could finish her record, Selena was shot and killed by former fan club president Yolanda Saldivar on March 31, 1995. She was 23 years old. Selena may physically be gone, but the essence of who she was still permeates our culture today, 25 years after her death. It's not just her songs, but her sense of fashion and style, too. Since Selena's death, there have been everything from Selena-inspired clothing and makeup lines to tribute albums, concerts, musicals, memorials, Barbie dolls, wax figures, drag shows, and various other art forms celebrating her life, including a new series from Netflix. Christian Serratos is spot on as Selena. When Selena passed away, I told my family that I was going to try to keep her memory alive through her music, Selena's father, Abraham Quintanilla Jr., told People in March. And 25 years later, I think we as a family accomplished that. Here we take a look back at the days leading up to Selena's death and explore her legacy today. How did Selena die? A month before her death, Selena was at the height of her career. On February 26, 1995, she performed with her band Los Dinos for more than 60,000 people at the Houston Astrodome in her iconic purple pantsuit. A few days later, she attended the Grammy Awards for a second time, where her fourth studio album, Amor Prohibido, was nominated for Best Mexican-American Performance. She lost, but in 1994, Selena Live won the Grammy for Best Mexican-American Album. She was also recording I Could Fall in Love with noted songwriter and producer Keith Thomas in Franklin, Tennessee. And outside of music, Selena was looking to expand Selena Etc., a boutique brand that she launched the year prior with stores in San Antonio and her hometown of Corpus Christi, Texas. But in early March 1995, Selena and her family discovered financial problems with her fan club and fashion brand. They accused Saldivar, who was promoted to manage the boutiques after her successful work with the club, of not sending fans items that they paid for, as well as embezzling $30,000, the Associated Press reported at the time. Selena tried to recover those records on a few separate occasions, and on one such attempt, at a Days Inn motel in Corpus Christi, Saldivar shot Selena in the back with a .38 caliber revolver. The bullet shattered an artery in her collarbone before exiting her chest, the effects of which also negatively impacted her brain function, according to the Associated Press. Several motel employees later testified that Selena came running into the motel's lobby after being shot and chased by Saldivar. She gave Saldivar's name and room number before she collapsed and was rushed to Corpus Christi Memorial Hospital, where she was pronounced dead, the AP reported. This testimony was in conflict with Saldivar's defense, that she shot Selena by accident. Saldivar was found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison, though over the years she's maintained her innocence and filed for several appeals to no avail. The sudden loss of Selena was so devastating that many couldn't believe the news at first. Maria Aguirre, a receptionist for Tejano radio station KQQK at the time of the singer's death, told the New York Times that calls from fans poured in as the news of her being shot spread, many of whom were calling to confirm that Selena died. "They cannot believe that it happened," she had said. "It's almost like the feeling when John Lennon died. She was the queen of Tejano." What happened to Selena's family? Selena's family, Abraham, her mother Marcella, her siblings Abraham III, or AB for short, and Suzette, as well as her husband Chris Perez, are alive and well today. While AB, Chris, and Suzette were part of Los Dinos, only AB and Chris went on to keep making music and form new bands, though there have been a couple of Los Dinos reunions over the years, including the 2015 Billboard Music Awards. Suzette manages the family's entertainment company and studio, Q Productions, that her father founded in 1993 and where Selena herself recorded music. The studio is also home to the Selena Museum that the family built in response to the thousands of letters mailed to them by fans expressing their desire to have Selena's memory shared with the public. Suzette also worked closely with MAC Cosmetics on their second Selena collection. And the Selena Foundation that Abraham and his wife Marcella run to help children in need has partnered with local groups in Texas to bring together live events honoring Selena, such as the Fiesta de la Flor. In 2012, Chris released his memoir about his relationship with Selena, titled To Selena with Love. And last February, Selena's father shared on his Facebook that he finished co-writing his own book with Nancy De Los Santos, who was a co-producer on the 1997 Selena biopic starring Jennifer Lopez that catapulted both the late singer and the actress into global recognition. On the 20th anniversary of the Selena movie in 2017, Abraham and Suzette sat down with Entertainment Tonight to reflect on Selena's legacy. "She had this beautiful personality and this amazing talent," Suzette said. "Combining all that together, I think that's why we're still talking about her." Later that same year, the family was present to unveil Selena's star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. It was reportedly one of the biggest crowds organizers had seen. Selena remains not only one of the most beloved, but one of the most successful Mexican-American artists to date. The posthumous release of Dreaming of You in July 1995, her record label combined her four English songs with earlier Spanish-language hits and covers, sold 175,000 copies in its first day alone, a record for female artists at the time. A month later, it debuted at number one on the Billboard's Top 200, and up until 2018, the album spent the second most weeks at number one on Billboard's Top Latin Albums chart. She broke barriers within male-dominated Tejano music, a style that combines genres such as folk, mariachi, and cumbia, while putting her own spin on it. This allowed her to appeal to both her Mexican and American audiences. While Selena was not the first or last Latina or Hispanic artist to cross over, Bad Bunny, J Balvin, and Rosalia are some of the artists who have Spanish language songs on both Latin and U.S. charts today, her accessibility remains a unique example and inspiration. "I think she still represents the possibility of being a complete American, while still being Mexican enough, and not losing touch with her family or her roots," Jose Lamon, professor emeritus at the University of Notre Dame, told NBC News. "This is the sort of contradiction that all Latinos live with, and she embodied it and navigated both worlds successfully." New York Times bestselling author Shay Serrano shares a similar sentiment in the Selena chapter of his book, Movies and Other Things. He recalls the scene where Abraham, played by Edward James Olmos, is explaining to his kids how exhausting it is trying to be Mexican enough for Mexicans and American enough for Americans. "The movie represented us, and it did so in a way that rarely happened then, and even more than two decades later, rarely happens now," he wrote. While Latina representation remains low, not just in movies, but across various other industries, the public mourning of Selena's death and the many tributes, including the movie, marked both a shift in and enabled greater Latina visibility. Author and scholar Deborah Paredes explores this in her paper, Remembering Selena, Remembering Latinidad. She considers how People, then People Weekly, launched People in Español a year after their issue on Selena's death sold out, and how Selena Forever, the musical, shined a light on Latina people in theater. The musical ran from 1999 to 2001 in Texas and Los Angeles, and 95% of the cast members and most of the attendees were Latino, which demonstrated that a lack of representation was not for lack of talent, Paredes wrote. Ultimately, Selena's memory became a safe place for Latino people to assert their identity and demand their voices be heard. The Netflix show was one of many projects to commemorate Selena. On December 4th, Netflix released the first six episodes of a two-part miniseries about Selena's career. An ensemble piece, Selena the Series, focuses especially on Selena's time in her family band, Selena y Los Dinos. We all know Selena the icon, but this show is about her family and how they all played a pivotal role in her success, Gabrielle Chavara, who plays AB, tells OprahMag.com. Ricardo Chavira, who plays Abraham, agrees. We're going deeper into the dynamics of this family. You have fully realized characters and all the different family members. I think it's significant now because of the age in which we're living in, especially with COVID. A lot of families are spending more time together. It could be instrumental in us recognizing the significance of our own families and also the family of community, he says. Between the Netflix series and the planned books and albums from the Quintanilla family, a new generation will soon discover all that Selena was able to do when she was alive, and what she continues to do in death. Our next article, by Jennifer Need, is titled, Here's Why You Shouldn't Post Your COVID-19 Vaccination Card on Social Media. When it's finally your turn to get the COVID-19 vaccine, you'll probably want to shout it from the rooftops and share it on all your social media accounts. But before you share that joyful post-shot selfie, pause and put down your vaccine card. Multiple government agencies and viral videos are warning about the risks of posting vaccine card images online. Photos of COVID-19 vaccination cards should not be shared on social media. Posting content that includes your date of birth, healthcare details, or other personally identifiable information can be used to steal your identity, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. The cards show medically sensitive information that you definitely don't want floating around the internet for anyone to see. All those details in one place makes you vulnerable to scams and identity theft. There are known scammers taking advantage of the demand for COVID-19 vaccines and benefiting from the pandemic. They can use the info on your card, even just your full name and date of birth, to create phony vaccination cards or open credit cards in your name. Keep in mind that offers to purchase COVID-19 vaccination cards are scams, per the HHS. Valid proof of COVID-19 vaccination is only available from legitimate providers administering vaccines. If you suspect COVID-19 healthcare fraud, the HHS wants you to report it immediately online or call 800-HHS-TIPS or 1-800-447-8477. Instead of sharing your health deets with the world, you can snap your vaccination sticker alongside your big smile. Our next article, by Zoe Donaldson, is titled, This Woman is Working to End Food Apartheid in South Los Angeles. How far away is your local grocery store? A 10-minute walk? A 25-minute drive if the lights are green? 4 years ago, Olympia Ossett was regularly spending 2.5 hours on a city bus to stock up on kale, carrots, tomatoes, cashews, and the like. And not because she's some kind of foodie diva. All she wanted was decent nutrition, which in her hometown of South Los Angeles is remarkably hard to come by. A mere 91 grocery stores serve the area's approximately 820,000 residents, most of whom are Latinx or Black. Liquor stores, 119, drastically outnumber farmers markets, where there are only 5. Ossett, 29, had a food awakening 11 years ago when she went vegan during her freshman year at Howard University. Upon moving back home in 2012, she quickly realized that her personal struggle to find fresh produce nearby was community-wide. South LA qualifies as a food desert, an area in which access to fruits and vegetables is limited or punishingly far away. But deserts occur naturally, says Ossett, who prefers to say food apartheid. That term brings attention to the fact that this issue is man-made, the result of oppression. It's not an accident. In 2016, fed up with the local scarcity, Ossett launched Supermarket, a combination pop-up stand, though that's on hiatus since COVID struck, and grocery service. On weekdays, she and a crew of volunteers pick up yams, oranges, beets, and other healthy foods from farmers and organic wholesalers. The bounty is then organized order by order and left on about 100 doorsteps every weekend. To date, Supermarket has distributed 70,000 pounds of low-cost groceries. It held an emergency 1,400-pound grain and seed giveaway when the pandemic hit. Though she's careful to include familiar produce, bananas and mangoes don't grow locally, but our customers regularly use them, Ossett strives to introduce lesser-known ingredients, too. Education is a big part of the mission, she says. Someone once texted me a picture of fresh basil and asked, "What's this?" So I sent him a pesto recipe. He made it and texted back, "Oh my God, this is so good." Our next article, by Emma Patty, is titled This Couple Fell in Love While Saving Each Other's Lives. When Leah Niederthal, a then 35-year-old business consultant, rounded the corner of a local D.C. bar, she immediately felt that the stranger she had just locked eyes with was someone she needed to meet. It was an overwhelming feeling, Leah tells OprahMag.com, of seeing Emily, a then 23-year-old tech consultant, for the first time. As the night went on, the two kept exchanging glances. We spent the next hour just sort of staring at each other, Leah remembers. At the end of the night, Leah knew that she couldn't let this woman get away and asked for Emily's number. Later that night, Leah texted a friend to say, I think I met somebody special. Little did she know she had just met the woman who would one day save her life. On their first date, drinks turned into dinner, which turned into gelato. They quickly became inseparable and after a year decided to move in together. Leah was surprised by how easy and natural their relationship felt. People had told her that when she found the one, it would be easy, but Leah had never believed them. Now she did. Emily just radiated good energy, she says. Then one morning, as Leah and Emily were settling into their new home, something happened that would forever change the course of their lives. I was in the kitchen making coffee, Leah recounts. All of a sudden, my vision got splotchy. When I looked up, Emily looked at me, and I could tell she saw something was wrong. Leah could barely talk. Her left side felt numb, and one side of her face started to droop. Emily recognized these as the signs of a stroke and quickly called 911. At the hospital, they told Leah that she'd suffered from a series of strokes, but doctors weren't able to identify the cause. The couple was sent home without any answers. Over the next couple of months, Leah found herself struggling to read and find the right words. Because of how much her work relies on her ability to read and communicate effectively, Leah was terrified that her symptoms might not improve, or worse, that they could mean yet another stroke was in her future. Emily and my mom sprang into action, trying to find the absolute best neurologist they possibly could, recalls Leah. They worked together to get Leah an appointment at Johns Hopkins, where she learned that the strokes she experienced were actually a rare complication of chronic migraines. Finally, they had an answer. For Leah, the experience showed how much Emily meant to her. I always knew that we were going to get engaged, but having been through that, it made our commitment to each other that much more important, says Leah. A few months later, Leah and Emily both secretly started shopping for engagement rings, and unbeknownst to each other, each of the rings arrived during the same week. I proposed to Emily on Saturday morning, Leah remembers, and she turned around and proposed back to me. After the stress and drama of Leah's medical scare, it finally felt like their lives were getting back on track. The couple started planning a wedding for the following spring, envisioning tying the knot with all their friends and family around them. But once again, life had something different in store. Shortly after their engagement, Emily started noticing tingling in her hands and feet, along with muscle twitches in her legs. Emily made an appointment with a neurologist, and the doctors discovered the tingling and twitches were a PTSD-related response to Leah's stroke. But that wasn't all. The testing had revealed Emily had a tumor in her brain. Thankfully, they had caught the tumor early, and Emily was a candidate for surgery, though the doctors warned that surgery had no guarantees. With such an uncertain future, Emily and Leah decided to elope. We didn't know if she was going to be the same after surgery, remembers Leah, adding that whatever did happen, we wanted to know we had been married. They went to the D.C. courthouse and got married the same day. 2 months later, Emily had a successful surgery and made a full recovery. Now Leah and Emily live in Brooklyn with their young son, Noah. Leah says what they've been through is part of what makes their marriage so strong. We joke that we saved each other, Leah says. When I had a stroke, Emily was so amazing. She kept calm. She knew who to call. She saved me. And the fact that I had a stroke saved her, because that's why she caught her tumor so early. Our next article by Maggie Griswold is titled, Athleta's Latest Launch is the Inclusivity Push in the Fitness Industry I've Been Waiting For. Those of us trying to be more active who don't fit society's image of what health and wellness looks like can often feel excluded. While the fitness industry has made strides in recent years, shopping for activewear can still prove challenging at times. I mean, really, how can any of us be expected to start hitting the gym when it's a challenge to even find workout gear that fits us? The double standard has been weighing on a lot of us for a really long time. but Athleta's latest push for inclusivity is moving the needle forward. Athleta now offers a more inclusive size range, from XXS to 3X to be exact, in over 500 different styles. These pieces include everything from the IG-worthy ultra-high-rise Elation tights and matching crop top, as well as bras and basic tanks. And by the way, those crop tops and supportive sports bras are available in extended cup size options. What's nice, the clothing can be found online as well as in all of their brick-and-mortar stores, so you can load up your virtual shopping cart or find your perfect fit in person. This last point is particularly important. I get that walking into a store knowing nothing offered will fit you isn't necessarily a lived experience for everyone. But for those of us who have gone through this, and realistically more than just a few times, this is big. Another plus, Athleta is one of the very few brands that don't separate size ranges. Everyone, no matter if they wear an XXS or a 3X, can shop from the same rack. As someone whose sizes have often been relegated to a dark corner at the back of a store, I can't overstate how much of a game changer this is. This also means that more of us can enjoy a shopping experience that's free, or at least freer, of shame and embarrassment. By simply putting together all sizes and placing them on the same rack, Athleta is helping create positive feelings so many of us have never experienced when shopping in the past. No more separating from friends just to find clothes that fit at the other end of a shop, and no more being forced to wait and order pieces online later. To top things off, every article of clothing was designed by active women of all shapes and sizes, who, Athleta will remind you, never believed one size actually fits all. So there's even more to love about this inclusive launch. Often, as sizes go up, manufacturers and designers merely add extra fabric. Unfortunately, this tends to create clothes that feel uncomfortable or unsupportive. I can't count how many pairs of leggings have failed on me or how many sports bras didn't fit the way they should. Yet, I wore them because they were the only options I had. With Athleta activewear, though, this isn't the case. The brand has tested and retested its pieces on many different body types to ensure the perfect fit. Look, I get it. My at-home dance fitness workouts, walks around the neighborhood, and occasional green smoothie might not qualify me as a fitness guru, but that shouldn't matter. I cherish my comfiest leggings and stretchiest sports bras as much as the next gal. And everyone deserves active wear in their size that actually fits. The health and wellness space still has a long way to go when it comes to feeling really genuinely inclusive. But for now, I'm raising my water bottle to Athleta. Our next article by Hamilton Kane is titled How One Father Found Hope in the Wake of Almost Unfathomable Loss. The last 24 hours of my son Owen's life were the worst 24 of mine. At dawn on Monday, January 11th, his nurse roused me to inspect secretions she'd suctioned from his mouth and tracheostomy, saliva flecked with mucus. She was nervous. Something wasn't right. He was ghost pale and groggy, but sat in his wheelchair for nearly 2 hours of remote learning with his teacher, who zoomed in from a cabin in upstate New York. Born with spinal muscular atrophy, SMA type 1, a leading genetic killer of children under the age of 2, Owen, now 18, had spent literally years of his life at the New York Presbyterian Morgan Stanley Children's Hospital and hooked up to life-saving devices at home amid surgeries, respiratory failures, erratic pulses, and x-rays even radiologists couldn't read. Over nearly two decades, we'd cultivated relationships with physicians, surgeons, and nurses that had sustained us through the G-forces of high fevers, mucus plugs, and blue resuscitation bags. The roller coaster seemed routine now, peaks and drops and sideways loops, all of us, my wife Ellen and I and our 15-year-old twins Peter and Nathaniel, strapped in and breathing hard. This was the organizing principle of our family. We made it much further than most. The streams of Facebook obituaries of SMA children were a constant reminder. Even if Owen's medical care often seemed like a Bergman plot, a knot-in-the-throat chess game with death. We had all grown used to Owen's fragility, the abrupt 0-60 tears, and the scary moments where mostly stray punctuation, exclamation points at the end of long, winding stretches of calm during which we played games of Clue, binged on British television shows like Doctor Who, and went out to his favorite overlook by Prospect Park Lake, where he'd watch flotillas of swans and mallards, turtles sunning on logs. On this Monday, Owen's vitals were close to normal, but the pallor. I was inclined to watch and wait. If he needed to see a doctor, I'd summon an ambulance, the only way Owen could travel, to transport us from Brooklyn to the hospital, a preemptive move rather than a 911 call. Ellen emailed Sarah Lesman, M.D., who'd covered him as a medical student during a seventh-month hospitalization in his infancy and later became his pediatric gastroenterologist. She knew his complex medical history like the back of her hand. She recommended that we bring him in for an evaluation. I called the medics. As we rode up the West Side Highway, the Hudson River winked with afternoon sunlight, and the medics joked that all Owen needed was a blood transfusion to pink up. Get you back home in just a few hours, buddy. I leaned over his gurney. Owen was asleep, rocked gently by the vehicle's motion. A legal adult, but just 60 pounds, crabbed with scoliosis. Through the windshield, I glimpsed the exit for Washington Heights, and the ambulance veered onto the off-ramp. I'd done this dozens of times since he was a baby. No cause for alarm. But as I stepped out of the ambulance, I noticed Owen's lips had whitened to the color of paper. The minute we wheeled him into the emergency department, his blood pressure and body temperature plummeted. A crew rushed into a triage space, a blur of white coats and stethoscopes and plastic aprons. Frantic pages for catheters, IVs, technicians, heating blankets. I was banished to the corridor where I waved away a priest. At the center of the frenzy, my child's body curved among a tangle of sheets, chin wedged against a pillow, a wisp of hair. I felt lightheaded. My lips parched beneath a surgical mask. My temples throbbed. A vagueness, like a dream. I remembered the first day I'd spent with Owen's mother 30 years earlier, picnicking in Central Park, flirting. Ellen had scored tickets to a Warhol show at the Museum of Modern Art. Did I want to come? The blizzardy March afternoon we married in her godmother's vast Upper West Side apartment, panes puffed with snow. My rosebud boutonniere, her ivory wedding dress. The day Owen was born in November 2002, unseasonably warm and humid, the emergency C-section, his treble cries and alert stare as the OBGYN lifted him to meet his parents. I came to with a landline phone in my hand, my wife's voice buzzing from the receiver. Hello? Hello? Posted everywhere throughout the emergency department was the same sign, a red arrow with the word resilience in all caps. A one-word rebuke to a pandemic that has killed more than 500,000 Americans. Many hospitals, including this one, had morphed into the front lines of an escalating war, so the peppy mantra was designed to lift the spirits of patients and physicians alike. I wasn't prepared to be back here like this. Hadn't we just celebrated another Christmas in Owen's bedroom, his wheelchair draped in tinsel? Hadn't we stayed up on New Year's Eve to watch 2020 flow into 2021, the ball dropping in Times Square? Owen's lab work baffled the clinicians. Could just be severe dehydration or anemia. After 3 hours of triage, he was moved upstairs to the PICU, where the intensivist hunched over him as his veins clamped down, mottling his skin. One foot turned purple. His blood pressure seesawed. Staff flocked in and out as I eavesdropped. We're looking good. We're not looking so good now. Have we titrated down on the epinephrine? We just had to escalate again. This is worse than before. Jeffrey Edwards, M.D., the attending physician in the PICU that day, hovered a few feet away, rail thin, unshaven, visibly weary. He was midway through a 30-plus hour shift. He scanned his computer screen as data ticked into Owen's chart. He shook his head and paced. Dad, he said, using the form of address common in the hospital. Owen's IV isn't sufficient. I need to put in a central line. It's literally life or death, but I'm having trouble finding a blood vessel. I can't even detect a pulse in his groin. His lips tightened. Just then, a surgical resident walked by us and noticed my Brooklyn Tech hoodie and grinned. I'd bought it when my son Nathaniel had enrolled there. Tech! Hella awesome, he says to me. I went to Tech. Despite the gravity of the moment, Edwards laughed. Then back to business. A PICU fellow, bent over Owen with a glowing portable ultrasound, finally gave a thumbs up. Okay, looks like we have something. The internal jugular, Edwards explained to me, like I was a first-year med student. A fat vein that will funnel the medication directly to the heart. Not the carotid, but we have no choice. Owen's hanging on by a thread. Sepsis, the body's extreme reaction to an infection, a swift, efficient killer, lurked like a black wolf at the back of my mind. Probably Edwards, too. Dr. Edwards, I said, calling on the clinical equanimity I'd faked for so many years. It was either that or dissolve into a puddle of bile. Don't you think the signs point to sepsis? He glanced at Owen's bedside monitors, swallowed hard, Adam's apple bulging beneath his mask. Sure, but he's already on a broad antibiotic that would be dealing with that, and his hemoglobin is low. Sepsis wouldn't make that go down. By midnight, Edwards and his team had painstakingly inserted a central catheter into the vein, allowing them to give Owen a much-needed blood transfusion. As his blood pressure inched up, color bloomed in his cheeks. His temperature climbed 5 degrees, just below normal. I could feel the nurse's anxiety ebb slightly. Edwards still paced, but seemed less taut. "Try to get a little sleep on that chair," he said. I grabbed a pillow and blanket, but had never felt more alert. I didn't need reminding by that red arrow taped to the wall opposite Owen's room. I'm damn brilliant at resilience. I've been doing this for almost 2 decades. By 7 a.m. Tuesday, Owen's blood pressure, though still low, had plateaued. I felt a hand on my shoulder rousing me. It was Shazia Meeman, a pediatric critical care nurse who over the years had become a friend of the family, offering me coffee. Dressed in scrubs and hijab, she always seemed to walk in a beam of light. I sprang up and kissed Owen on the forehead as he slumbered beneath a dose of fentanyl. His echocardiogram had shown relatively normal heart function, and though he still required supplementary oxygen and high ventilator pressure to breathe, he was stably unstable, as Edwards put it. There was an undertow of tension, but nothing to rattle my instincts. Breathe deep and exhale. Clear sunlight flooded the space as the clinical teams rounded on him just after 9 a.m. We formulated a plan that would require a lengthy hospitalization, elaborate interventions, something Ellen and I had navigated many times. I huddled with Edwards and his colleagues just outside Owen's room, mapping out the day's pressing items, what needed to be done. His body was poised to rebound, hour by hour. I saw Sarah, Owen's GI physician, a few feet away, face half-swathed by an N95 mask. She crinkled her eyes at me. This first comeback day would be a delicate ballet. Special antibiotics for bacteria and more blood cultures, an arterial line, a CT scan. Let's see whether the steroids work their magic by afternoon and... And in the blink of an eye, Owen's heart stopped beating. Alarms, a flat green line on his monitor. Shouts of crash cart now, as doctors and nurses and respiratory therapists whip past me, surging toward his bed. Through the door, I could see a white-haired woman bob her torso up and down violently as she compressed his chest. Numerous syringes, some the kind used to resuscitate Uma Thurman in Pulp Fiction. By coincidence, I was standing between two women who had long cared for him, Sarah and Shazia, Jew, Christian, and Muslim. How very New York. Edwards strode back and forth with updates. He wasn't able to detect any electric activity in the organ. Then another report. I'm throwing everything at him now. And then, I suspect he's already passed, but even if I get him back, his brain may very well be damaged. If I hadn't had Sarah and Shazia at my side, my knees would have buckled. I would have vomited, or fainted, or something. But with them near me, they all knew and loved Owen so well and for so many years, I whispered to myself that resilience sign lurking at my shoulder. Just get through the next 10 minutes. The eventuality of this moment had haunted me since his babyhood like a frenemy, bathing the good times in its radiance, knocking the breath out of me when I turned away for some trivial moment, a bowl of Cheerios, a trip to the John, a shave. All these years I'd bartered with God, just get him to his second birthday. Okay, his seventh. Cool, I'll take a bar mitzvah year. His mom's Jewish after all. Sweet 16. 18. Wow. Can we go for 21? 24? You call the shots and I'll be so good and strong inside, even though most days I want to scream my full head off and buy a one-way ticket to Cancun. And now all that borrowed time had snapped off like a power line in a high wind, dwindling to 10 minutes, 5, 50 seconds, 15, 10. The team did CPR for 27 minutes before Edwards pronounced my son dead at 10:09 a.m., and I stepped away to call my wife. After Sarah had kindly driven out to Brooklyn to fetch Ellen, after the nurses had washed the IV and catheter sites, wiping blood off Owen's wrists and neck, and then gowned him, after we'd sat on either side of his bed, clinging to Shijia's words like life buoys. After I'd held Owen's limp, lumped hands for the final time, rubbed his nose with mine, our goodnight ritual. After we'd cried in an Uber on the trip back to Brooklyn, somehow we managed to scramble a little supper and sit with our twins at the kitchen table. Nathaniel, husky as a football player, dark hair plumed across his forehead, was confrontational. His repressed feelings spilled out in a 3-hour interrogation. Ellen and I sipped our wine and let him release the burden he'd carried inside his whole life. He'd never gone on a proper family vacation like his friends. He'd never had both parents in the audience during his orchestra performances, his middle school role in Macbeth done in goth style. Owen and I always wanted what the other had, he said. I wanted your attention, and he wanted to walk. Already he was realizing what we would need to grapple with in addition to our unbearable loss. We love Owen and always will, but there's something radically different ahead of us, Nathaniel said. Ellen and I looked at each other. We, all four of us, had been laser-focused all these years on keeping Owen alive. Now that he was gone, what had defined our lives would be gone too. The 24-hour-a-day comings and goings of nurses, the beeping and humming of life support machines, a ventilator, a feeding pump, a pulse oximeter, sleeping with one eye always open, steeling ourselves to meet medical crises, being tethered to home, our sweet, sweet boy. Now there was just a void. 3 months later, we're still navigating the pandemic and our grief within the confines of our apartment, but the days are noticeably longer. We're planning an open-air summer gathering in Owen's honor at the Overlook by Prospect Park Lake, where we'll dedicate a bench with a commemorative plaque right where he used to watch the swans. We've all gravitated towards his bedroom, forever known as Owen's room, with its vast closets and 3 tall windows and spangles of afternoon light, its sky blue walls and framed pictures of our boy. Ellen has picked up an old habit, watching PBS cooking shows on TV. I want to try this Lydia Bastianach recipe, hun. Nathaniel and Peter spread out on the couch with their laptops, both mulling the puzzles of chemistry. And most evenings, I fan out my novels across the bird's-eye maple bed, slumping against a bank of goose-down pillows, knees tucked beneath a comforter, and Owen's bed becomes a portal, a magic carpet that whisks me off to Barbados, or a craggy coast in Ireland, or the prairies of Iowa, or to see him. Signs were moving in the right direction. I read until my eyes itch with sleep, and then I lean across the dresser to switch off the lamp. Our next article by Sarah Klein is titled 6 Breast Cancer Symptoms That Have Nothing to Do with Feeling a Lump. A breast cancer diagnosis often goes something like this. A woman feels a lump on her breast and makes a doctor's appointment. The doctor conducts some tests, which may include a breast exam, mammogram, ultrasound, biopsy, or a combination, and determines the lump is cancerous. That's why women are encouraged to complete self-exams regularly and be familiar enough with their breasts to notice any changes. But a lump isn't the only breast cancer symptom to keep your eye out for. In fact, a 2017 study published in the journal Cancer Epidemiology found that 1 in 6 women diagnosed with breast cancer experience a spectrum of symptoms other than breast lump. Because there's not as much awareness of these less common breast cancer symptoms, the researchers hypothesized that so-called atypical presentations could be delaying some women's diagnoses. Of course, an earlier diagnosis results in earlier treatment, which typically tends to work best, says Joseph Weber, MD, a breast surgical oncologist at Aurora Healthcare in Milwaukee. That's not to say you should stop inspecting your breasts. In the cancer epidemiology study, 83% of the women who had breast cancer symptoms and were diagnosed found a lump first. However, a little more awareness of other signs can't hurt. Our results highlight opportunities for a shift in emphasis in symptom awareness campaigns toward breast symptoms other than breast lump, the researchers write. Dr. Weber agrees. If women notice any changes in their breasts, they need to have a professional evaluate them, he says. Talk to a doctor about anything that looks different from their normal appearance. Here are the main breast cancer symptoms to watch out for. Skin irritation or dimpling. A rough patch of skin that feels scaly or thicker than usual, or skin that starts to dimple, can signal breast cancer, Dr. Weber says. With some breast cancers, channels that go from the inside of the breast to the skin become blocked, resulting in skin changes that make the breast look like it's covered with an orange peel. Breast or nipple pain. Many things can cause pain in your breasts or nipples, like PMS, pregnancy, or even menopause. But if you notice persistent pain along with other breast cancer symptoms, it's important to report the experience to your doctor, regardless if it's a sharp twinge or a dull ache. Nipple retraction. Some breast cancers will cause what's called nipple inversion or retraction, in which the nipple turns inward. Typically, that's because a mass is growing inside the breast and changes its shape, Dr. Weber explains. In the recent research, 7% of the women who are diagnosed with breast cancer reported nipple abnormalities. Nipple discharge. Another possible nipple abnormality can be discharge that's not breast milk. Nipple discharge is thankfully most often not cancer, but it's important to see a doctor immediately if the discharge comes out without you touching or squeezing the nipple, especially if it's bloody and only affecting one side. Color or texture changes. This can include redness, darkening, scaliness, or thickening of the nipple or breast skin. One type of breast cancer called Paget disease, a rare form that starts at your breast ducts and spreads to the nipple and areola, is often accompanied by a rash. And lastly, swelling of all or part of a breast. Inflammatory breast cancer often starts with red, inflamed skin that swells as cancer cells clog the vessels that carry lymph fluid. Our next article by Melissa Goldberg is titled Gloria Steinem Takes Us Inside Her Office. It's both a nest and a symbol of freedom. In 1960, if you were a woman living in the United States, odds were you couldn't apply for a credit card without a man's signature. You would also be barred from attending most Ivy League schools, legally be paid less than men for doing the same job, and have had few to zero rights when it came to making decisions about your own marriage or uterus. Women have undoubtedly come a long way since then, thanks in large part to the pioneering efforts of feminist icons like Gloria Steinem, who at that point was turning 26, moving to New York City, and getting to work. Over the past six decades, Steinem has shaped American culture. She's broken barriers as a journalist, reporting on everything from the early days of the pill to the working conditions of Playboy bunnies. A political activist, she co-founded the Women's Action Alliance and the National Women's Political Caucus. And an editor, she launched and presided over Miss Magazine. In case that wasn't enough for one's resume, she's also an author, film producer, and tireless champion of women's rights, both at home and abroad. Even now, at an age when many might want to slow down, 87-year-old Steinem is still speaking, organizing, demonstrating, educating, campaigning, and influencing generations of girls and women. That explains why, as Steinem tells me when we speak by phone, my office, and especially my desk in the corner, is where I spend almost all of my time. The inviting area is located on the ground floor of Steinem's New York residence, where she's lived for more than 55 years. In 1966, Steinem and a roommate moved into the brownstone's second floor apartment, where she held the first meetings for what would become Miss Magazine. When I was 30, I thought you had to follow a certain life pattern, which was that you married, your husband's identity became perhaps more important than your own, and you had children, she says. I still thought I would do that, but just not right now. And I kept saying not right now for many years. It wasn't until I turned 50 that I realized people could live in different ways. In 1989, Steinem bought the brownstone's lower level and turned part of it into an office. Having a space where I could do my work was very important to me, says Steinem, who spent childhood summers in Michigan, where her father ran a dance pavilion. In the winter, he put our family in a little house trailer, and we made our way selling antiques to local roadside shops. There was not much private space in a house trailer, so this may have been more important to me than most people. Today, her spirited office is filled with mementos and eclectic treasures, from an iconic image of her and Dorothy Pittman Hughes to the first issue of Miss, to an antique frame that's been used as a bedboard, a bookcase, and now a mirror. It's hosted people both ordinary and extraordinary, and leads to what Steinem describes as an infinitesimal backyard. Most importantly, though, that room offers a sense of place, she says. It's both a nest and a symbol of freedom. Ahead, the woman practically synonymous with American feminism gives us a peek at the space where she's most creative, revealing her prized possessions, favorite photographs, the pins she swears by, and more. My ideal work schedule. I feel most creative when I'm writing late at night. I have all good intentions of getting up and starting early, but I need the guilt of the day, not to mention the absence of phone calls, to really begin writing. I'll get going between 9 and 11 p.m., and then I usually stay up until 2 or 3 a.m. I've never actually had a job, so I've never been on a 9-to-5 schedule. Yes, we were at Miss Magazine for years, but that was our office, so we could make our own hours. Some people like to come in early, and, well, I didn't. In fact, for me, the perfect day would consist of getting up in the morning, whatever time the morning represented, and walking around the corner to Alex's Deli to pick up a soy chai latte and a bran muffin. I'd come back to my desk and answer emails, which can be quite lengthy and seductive, and then hopefully work on something more lasting than emails. My favorite part of writing. The only thing that's better than finding the right word for a thought or story, when a reader carries your words into their story, it means something is better because you lived. My trick for beating writer's block. Whenever I feel stuck, I'll grab a legal pad, especially if I've been on my computer for a while. There's something about writing by hand that is more intimate. One of Alice Walker's books is titled A Poem Traveled Down My Arm, and I think that perfectly captures the feeling. It's visceral, and I almost always use a Uniball Vision Elite pen, which I've been buying for years now. Whereas pencils have to continuously be sharpened, these pens keep going for a long time, so I find them preferable myself. Maybe if you publish that, they'll send me a free supply. My most cherished wall hanging. I have all sorts of things hanging on my wall that are important to me, but one of the most meaningful items is a poem that Alice Walker wrote for me. We appeared at the 92nd Street Y together for a talk, and she started reading a piece she'd written just before we got on stage. It wasn't until the very end that she revealed that the she in the poem was indeed me. It's a moment I'll never forget, so I had it written out by a calligrapher, which I then framed. My fireplace. For millennia, we've been gathering in circles around campfires, so there's something timeless and crucial about having a fire in the fireplace. That's especially true these days when it's rare that buildings not only have fireplaces, but also chimneys that are in working condition. I think that's part of the reason why a lot of people comment on the fireplace in my office. But I confess, even though they may look real, the logs aren't actually made of wood. And the fire? Well, it's actually gas. Nonetheless, though, it still serves the spiritual purpose. There are two things in my office that almost everyone asks about. The first is a letter from distant cousins who I barely know, in which they formally disown me. They wrote it around the time when Angela Davis was wrongly charged and tried in court because I was the treasurer of the Angela Davis Legal Defense Fund. They felt that I was being disloyal to the country, but it wasn't painful at all. In fact, I framed it. The other is a soccer ball that Megan Rapinoe gave me when she visited a couple years ago. It's autographed by players of the U.S. Women's National Team, and I swear people are more knocked out by that than just about everything else. My favorite photographs. I'm surrounded by pictures of friends. There's a big 8x10 photo of me, Alice Walker, and Wilma Mankiller, and there's another of me and Marcia Gillespie, who was an editor at both Miss Magazine and Essence Magazine, and in both, everyone is laughing. One of my most prized pictures, though, is actually an unframed snapshot hanging on my bulletin board. The picture was taken from behind, and in it, I'm sitting at a round table with David Bale, or the friend that I married, as we referred to each other. He has his arm resting on the back of my chair in this very protective way, and it's just this great, evocative image. My flower habit. One of the things I treasure most is a bunch of fresh flowers. Not only do they represent a connection to nature, but they also suggest a certain amount of prosperity. If you can buy flowers, it means you have enough food. I love white lilies, and in my infinitesimal backyard, I planted a Cherokee Chief dogwood after my friend, and the first female principal chief of the Cherokee Nation, Wilma Mankiller, died. I'm sure Wilma didn't know there was such a thing as Cherokee Chief Dogwood, but nonetheless, it has these beautiful pink blossoms in the spring, and pink was her favorite color. When it's in bloom, I'll cut some branches and place them in my office. My beloved bulletin board. In my opinion, a bulletin board is essential. It's a place of both urgency and memory, because I can display photographs of people I care about, reminders of emails or projects that need to be addressed immediately, things that inspire outrage, and letters that people send me. The notes from children, of course mostly little girls, are especially moving, and I often keep them up there until they turn to shreds. One of my favorites was from a little girl who said something like, "The boys get the good part of the playground, and we can only play jacks in the corner. We girls are angry as turnips." My must-read books. I have books everywhere, so several generations of friends and helpers have created little signs to help me organize my bookshelves by topic. There are so many books that are important to me, but the ones about Native America have special importance because they're a reminder that everything we want was once here. The Iroquois Confederacy is the oldest living democracy on Earth, yet most history books unfortunately start with Columbus, a lousy navigator who thought he was in India and couldn't understand why women resisted becoming sex slaves for his crew. It's more profound to begin with the first humans on the land where we stand, including in our own backyards. My most meaningful award. There's a small statue, or statuette, in my office that without fail fills me with pride. It's the Last Girl Award, and it was given to me by my friend Ruchira Gupta, who founded the anti-trafficking organization APNI App. The grassroots group talks about the last girl, which is inspired by Mahatma Gandhi, who measured progress by the health, status, and life of the last man, and every year they pay tribute to a few people who have fought to empower women and eradicate sex trafficking. Most awards are inherently exclusive. They honor you for getting to the top of a hierarchy. But the one that Ruchira created is inclusive. My powerful piece of history. Hanging in the entryway to my office is a framed print of a full-page ad that ran in the New York Times when Anita Hill testified against then-Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas. It's titled "African American Women in Defense of Ourselves" and features the names of 1,600 women who wanted to voice their support for Anita Hill. To me, that poster embodies a woman's movement. It's a tragedy that one woman is devalued, humiliated, hurt, or killed, but support of her can change the future. Our next article by Mackenzie Jean Philippe is titled "The Best Books About Summer Romance That Will Whisk You Away." Finding Joy by Adriana Herrera. When Desta travels to Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, for work, a place that comes with emotional familial ties, he meets Elias, the literal perfect man. The doctoral student is working towards a future where he can finally be himself. The two quickly fall for one another as they travel across Ethiopia. One Hot Italian Summer by Karina Halley. When grief gives her a terrible case of writer's block, Grace's agent sends her to her home in Tuscany to find inspiration. Enter Claudio, a sexy single father who is irresistible and off-limits. 40 Love by Olivia Dade. While on vacation, an assistant principal loses her bikini top during a dip in the ocean. She's saved from embarrassment by Lucas, a former tennis pro and trainer at the resort. A steamy summer romance blossoms, but an age difference, a time limit, and long distance are all strikes against their future. Mango Summer by Agay Yanera. The fruit in Fiona's mango farm is sour for the first time in a century. The reason? She doesn't have a husband or kids, and family legend says the woman who watches over the farm must have both. Enter Greg, the younger brother of Fiona's best friend, whose long-standing crush soon turns into something more. A Summer for Scandal by Lydia San Andres. In this historical 20th century summer romance that takes place in a fictional island in the Spanish Caribbean, we meet Amelia and Ruben. She writes a popular and scandalous serial under a pseudonym and he edits a gossip paper and is determined to uncover her identity. Beach Read by Emily Henry. Writers January Andrews and Augustus Everett are complete opposites. She's a best-selling romance novelist and he pens acclaimed literary fiction. But two things they do have in common? They're neighbors for the summer and they both have writer's block. They make a deal in the hopes that'll inspire them to be more creative, but their pact also ends up leading them into a passionate romance. Call Me Your Name by Andre Ackerman. Adapted into an Oscar-winning film co-starring Timothée Chalamet and Armie Hammer against the backdrop of Italy, this legendary romance explores the hidden love of a teenage boy named Elio and an alluring doctoral student serving as his father's intern. The Law of Moses by Amy Harmon. In this heartbreakingly beautiful love story, Georgia can't help but fall for her small Utah town's black sheep, Moses Wright. But as their attraction grows, they become ensconced in rumors after Moses' mysterious magical ability gets him implicated in a local tragedy. Seasoned by Delaney Diamond. Diamond's Seasoned contains a trio of romances as it follows three women with very different love stories who all just want a chance at happiness. The Proposal by Jasmine Guillory. After writer Nicole Peterson awkwardly rejects her boyfriend's scoreboard proposal at Dodger Stadium, she's saved from embarrassment by the sexy doctor Carlos Ibarra. You can imagine what happens next. The Truth About Forever by Sarah Dessen. Known to many as the master of young adult summer romance, Dessen introduces us to Macy, who unexpectedly finds herself working at Wish Catering for the summer. Soon her careful plans unravel, particularly when she meets the irresistible Wes. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.